The days are shortening and cool weather is on its way, so it's time for some late season gardening tips. With this recent surge of warm weather, it doesn't really feel like it's time to put your garden to bed. And if you don't want to, you don't have to. Not yet. But soon. Maybe this year you'll do something different. Maybe you'll save some tomato seeds for next year or plant a cover crop. Maybe you've been experimenting with some tender bulbs and wonder whether you need to dig them up. And if so, when? Or whether you need to protect young fruit trees. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we have the experts with the answers to your gardening questions. Barbara Murphy of Gardeners Growing Healthy Communities and Bill Kalina of the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. All green thumbs up. Maine Calling is next. But first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Fall is finally here. Many gardeners are enjoying their late season harvest, and they're thinking about getting the garden ready for winter. Today, two of our favorite gardening experts are with me to answer all of your questions about planting, pruning, putting the garden to bed for the winter. In the studio with me, Barbara Murphy, coordinator for Gardeners Growing Healthy Communities, and Bill Kalina, executive director of the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. As always, we want to hear from you. We want to hear your gardening questions. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome back to both of you. And at the end of the program, the last time we talked, we said next time we are going to talk about seed saving. And we have remembered, all three of us. You guys probably didn't need to remember, but I made a note of it. And this is, Barbara, this is when to start thinking about it, right?
It all depends. Seed saving, like if you're finishing up with some green beans and there's some pods there that you didn't see and they've gotten big and bloated, those are your future seeds for next year if you just allow them to dry down. But other crops require planting when you plant them.
Oh, really?
Like squash, the whole squash family, you want to make certain there's enough distance or enough time because those are insect pollinated and they can get cross-pollinated, making a squumpkin, a squash and a pumpkin cross.
Did you make up that word?
It's commonly used in the trade.
Oh, that's in the Urban Dictionary.
Oh, but, there you have it.
The squumpkin. Before I go off of you, Barbara, and ask Bill about flowers, so right now, so that's a good idea if you have some beans just kind of still hanging in there.
Beans, lettuce.
Beans, peas. So, okay, so how do I seed lettuce?
It has to go to flower. Needless to say, you have to not harvest everything. And that sometimes is impossible for many of us gardeners. So you'd have to let a lettuce or two, preferably, just come to flower. And the flower is going to form seed. And the seed needs to ripen, so it needs to be a little firm. You can cut the head off and shake it into a bag.
Okay.
There you have it. And Jennifer's eyes are like whirling at me.
I'm thinking, am I really going to try this? I've never done it.
I've only done it once. Sometimes me, personally, I'm just not organized enough to pull it off.
What about tomatoes?
You can always just take a fruit or two. And preferably, Bill and I were talking about this earlier, the fruit that really is spectacular, which makes it tricky because you aren't supposed to eat that one. And just let it keep ripening on your counter until it's overripe. Then you want to scoop out those seeds. Some people add water to that and ferment the seeds a little bit. But you must get that gel off. So either with a little water to have that gel separate, or you can rub the gel off.
And when you say over-ripen to when it's just kind of smushy and starting to fall apart?
Yeah, when those fruit flies are looking good. Yeah.
Okay, Bill, top that. What would you recommend for someone, a perennial gardener or somebody who likes annual flowers, never tried to save seeds? Are there some that you can?
Just about. You know, most perennials you can collect seeds on if they're not a double flower and they're not a complex hybrid that are sterile, basically. So the easy things are, you know, things in the daisy family, for example, the heads in the center. You think of a cone flower or a black-eyed Susan or a cosmos. What I collect to seed on a lot is annuals. If I plant seed-grown annuals in my garden, I collect them. I've collected, you know, thousands and tens of millions of seeds in my life. But those are the things that it's so easy to collect a few and dry them out, and then I just take them, and once they've dried for a couple of weeks, and I just put them in an envelope in the refrigerator till next spring, right on, of course, what they are, And then you'll have them for next year.
So if you have an annual that you want to try this with, would you wait until the flower petals have fallen off? Or do you just go ahead and harvest the flower and maybe set it on a paper towel? I mean, what would you do?
Yeah, the ultimate key is that the seed itself, and if you're not sure what the seeds look like, there's just like everything else, put it into Google and say, you know, cosmos seed, and you'll get see pictures of it. But the seed coat, the outer part of the seed, is going to have to be a dark color, usually like a tan or brown or black. And the seed feels firm. That means it's mature. But the cue to that is that the flower's dried up, and usually it's anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks after the flower is finished flowering, like the petals have fallen off, so you got to leave it for a while.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I fight at work is that the gardeners are very fastidious and are always deadheading things, cutting all the spent flowers off, and I go out there to collect seed and there's nothing left. But
so if they're deadheading, the seed is best if it's left to seed on the plant.
Yes.
So if they're deadheading and they take a handful, that doesn't work.
It's basically the seed, if it's matured to the point where the seed coat is brown, is darkened up, then you can take it off the plant. But before that, if you cut it, it won't continue to ripen. It's not being nurtured by the mother plant, and it will just never mature.
Okay.
And so that's what you have to – it's just like the lettuce. If you let the lettuce, a few of them bolt and go to seed, lettuce seed is kind of like dandelions. You know, it's in the same family as – and so it has sort of fluffs out, and you know that it's ready to go.
So that's probably why you can get some volunteers the next spring, especially lettuce seems to be something that is especially eager to volunteer in places that you didn't plant it in your garden.
Exactly. Okay. Assuming you didn't eat it all or weren't fastidious in tidying up. Sure.
And I like the tip you said about the refrigerator bill, because this is something I've learned from you all in programs in the past. Even if you bought your seeds, here it is at the end of summer, and you bought some vegetable or flower seeds in the beginning of the year. You didn't use them all. You can stick them in the freezer till next spring, correct?
Not the freezer, but the refrigerator part.
Okay.
The reason the freezer, if you haven't really dried them down enough, you can damage the seeds, but just I just put them in a bag or a mason jar in the back of the refrigerator, and it's amazing how much longer they'll survive. You can keep seeds for, you know, 2, 3, 4 years. If you buy a big packet of seeds, you don't use them all, just keep, you know, you can use them. The seed companies don't like you to say that, but they'll last for several years. And the one last thing I wanted to say that I think is really interesting is that for example, I've been growing basil in my garden. I got this fusarium that's attacking basil that comes in, and it the basil starts to just wilt and die. And so the last couple of years, I've been a couple of the plants more resistant than the others every year. And I saved the seeds from those plants. And now after the second year, I'm having much, much less problem with that disease. So I'm selecting for things that do better in my particular garden. And that's the nature of what heirloom seed saving is all about.
Right. So you're choosing which of these, not just which of the types of basil, but which actual plants did better my garden this year.
Yep.
Now, back to the refrigerator over the winter. I have, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, so that's why I'm asking this personal question. I have a whole bunch of seeds that I've just kept in the garage, my unheated garage. Instead of just throwing them out from past years, I try them anyway because they're kind of doing the natural getting cold in the winter. And
absolutely. They're just seed. So that's when, you know, you can do a germination test next spring, put 10 of them on a moist paper towel, put them in a Ziploc, and just give them a few days and see how many of that 10 germinated, and then extrapolate from there. If 9 of them did, you can say 90% of the remaining seeds will likely germinate that you have. I've had seeds for over 10 years in not the best of conditions, in and out of the refrigerator, sometimes on a hot shelf, and have gotten over 80% on many of them.
Over 80%. Wow. So we've talked about seed saving. It is fall officially now, and we're coming out of a warm stretch. What are you doing? What are the gardeners doing at the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens right now, Bill, to not only have a wonderful fall season, but also to start preparing for winter and getting ready for next spring?
Well, the way we cut back, obviously, the perennials, the annuals and everything, we used to leave a lot of the plants up. But as we've talked about on the show before, voles, those little critters, can be a real problem. So what we do this time of year is as the plants wither, they'll cut them back. And it leaves holes around. And what we've been doing is filling in with pumpkins and other sort of fall type things to, you know, for the display. So And they're also starting to string lights for the Gardens of Glow Light Festival now, too.
Oh, my goodness. But what we can learn from the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens and our own much smaller estates is that it's a good time to start cutting back, especially if we have a problem with voles.
Yeah, and cut back once the plants have yellowed or browned. You really don't want to cut anything back while it's still green, if possible, because that's just energy that plant could reabsorb it's lost.
Okay. Barbara, what's going on at Gardeners Growing Healthy Communities? What are you harvesting? What are you doing to get ready for next year?
Well, we're harvesting, of course, leeks and onions and carrots and beets and beans and chard. The garden really still is going full forward. Tomatoes are still – it was an amazing pepper year. We're still getting quite a few peppers. What I'm concerned about at that garden in particular is we planted blueberries this year. So they're first year planted, and it has been dry. So for the past month, we really haven't had any rains. And anyone who's listening who has perennial fruit in the ground, it would be good to get, and you haven't had water or aren't watering, it's good to start watering and get those plants watered well before the ground freezes.
All right. I was wondering, is it too late if you're the kind of person who might like to experiment with a cover crop for your garden? Is it too late to plant a cover crop?
No. Oats and winter rye are fine. Yep. The oats will get up, you know, lawn size, a few inches if you give them some water to get germinated quickly. And winter rye will just keep going. Oats will die with a hard frost. Winter rye won't.
Okay. And will you be doing that in the big community gardens that you work with?
It's scheduled for tonight.
Really?
Absolutely.
So our timing is perfect.
Perfect.
Okay, great. Well, we're going to start with some questions because we had questions coming in before the show even began. We'll start with Susan. You mentioned peppers, Barbara. Susan in Kennebunk writes, we planted two kinds of red peppers this year, small hot ones and sweet bell peppers. They have done very well. But for the necessary late planting in June, most are still green. With cooler weather on the way, can you please advise us as to what to do with these green peppers that still need to ripen to red?
If there's any, well, as long as the weather's dry, they'll keep ripening. So carry on. If we get into a stormy or more moist situation, they just need some protection, some plastic row cover, something that will just keep them dry. And if they're starting to turn a little bit red, you can bring them in. They won't get to that full red color that we see in maybe grocery store black peppers, but they'll redden further, absolutely.
So you can go ahead and pick them and put them on your kitchen windowsill? Or
they don't even have to be in light. They can't go from green to red in your kitchen. They would probably rot in between.
Okay, but if they're already starting to redden.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay. And if we start to have rain, just cover them up.
Absolutely.
Okay. This is from Larry. He doesn't say where he's from, but I have 18 high bush blueberries that I have been mulching every fall for several years with oak leaves. The yield was good for a few years, but the past two have produced nothing. And this year there is plenty of new growth, but no blossoms. The heavy pruning I did last year resulted in some plants sending out growth horizontally. The soil isn't as acid as I would like it to be. Do high bush blueberries stop producing after a certain time span? Also, I started saving seeds this year. Do they have to be from heirloom plants?
I'll do blueberries. You can do seeds? All right. Blueberries. So if I don't quite know what's happening with the horizontal growth.
He's cutting them back, he's cutting off the flowers.
Because
the flowers on blueberries are on the old wood that overwintered. So cutting the blueberries back,
you
won't get flowers.
Yeah, so it blueberries, like other spring fruit, you prune in the springtime. They do need acid soil. They live up to 25 or 30 years, so it's not that they would ever stop producing. The fact that he got no flowers is usually the pruned the wrong time indicator, operator error kind of a deal.
Or too shady.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he didn't say anything about sun.
No, he didn't.
Needs to be absolutely full sun.
Full sun, prune in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And what about saving the seeds?
Certainly heirloom by definition means it's a seed variety, and so it's not a complex hybrid. If you save seeds from complex hybrids, often the offspring's different from the parents. So heirlooms, you're going to have a better chance of getting what you have. But if you have five different heirloom varieties of the same thing growing together, you're going to get a mixture too. So it really is heirlooms and not have too many varieties of, like, too many different kinds of tomatoes or too many different kinds of, you know, other garden varieties together that can cross-pollinate.
Oh, interesting. If you'd like to ask a question, our email address is talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post to our Facebook page, or call 1-800-399-3566. We're talking about late season gardening. Our guests are Barbara Murphy and Bill Kalina. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more of your questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the law firm of Eaton Peabody's Real Estate Litigation Group, working to protect real estate interests throughout Maine.
On the next Fresh Air, the new wave of lobbyists in President Trump's Washington and how the chaos and uncertainty within the Trump administration have affected how lobbyists operate. We talk with New York Times political investigative reporter Nicholas Confessore, who covers wealth, power, and influence in Washington. Join us.
You can hear Fresh Air tonight at 7 on Maine Public Radio. The Weight of Memory is the final segment of Ken Burns' The Vietnam War. It airs this evening at 8 and again at 10 on Maine Public Television. The final episode covers Nixon resigning amidst Watergate, while a brutal civil war continues in Vietnam. North Vietnamese troops overtake Saigon with overwhelming force. And over the next 40 years, Americans and Vietnamese from all sides search for healing and reconciliation. It's not too late to watch any or all of this documentary. All of this week's episodes will be broadcast this Sunday from 8:30 in the morning to 6 in the afternoon. All the segments are also available on demand at mainepublic.org, through Passport, and on the many PBS apps for Apple TV, Roku, and other platforms.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, answers to your late season gardening questions. With me in the studio, Barbara Murphy, who is coordinator for Gardeners Growing Healthy Communities, and Bill Kalina is executive director of the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Before the break, we were talking about someone had asked, with his high bush blueberry bushes, did they need to be heirloom high bush blueberry bushes to save seeds? And Bill, you were explaining that if they were not hybrid, and I'm editing here, I'm shortening. Explain to me what people mean by heirloom. I think they go to the farmer's market, they see heirloom tomatoes, and they think this is some special, pure, old-fashioned seed. Is that accurate?
Yeah, but it's because everybody used to save seed, and not many people do anymore. So all an heirloom is typically is like if you grew up a tomato and you really liked it, and you saved the seed from that. And so for several years, you kept growing that, and it became the Jennifer Rooks tomato, and it was special. And then you gave some to your friends, and they gave them to friends, and it became this variety that people knew about. That's what it is, and it's called heirloom mainly because nobody does that anymore, and so it's like sort of something from the past. And so keeping these old varieties alive is keeping all that genetic diversity alive, which is so important, because now you think about the big seed houses with vegetables are doing most of the work, and everybody's growing the same thing, and there's not a lot of diversity there. So with diseases and climate and everything like that, whereas if you have, you know, 200, 300 different heirloom varieties that are all different, the diversity there means they're more adaptable as a group to, you know, changes in climate or regional climate or dry years or sunny years or insect pests and that kind of thing.
If you have the Jennifer Rooks variety of the heirloom tomato,
which is delicious, by the way.
Will it, over the years, change, especially if it were planted with other tomato varieties? And
yeah,
will it change in different people's gardens?
It will. You know, basically all you're doing is saying, I like that one, and I'm saving the seeds from that one. And the seeds won't, if it's in a fruit, won't be exactly like the parent fruit, but they'll be reasonably like it. And then the next year you save that. And if you've got lots of others together, yes, the genes from those will get mixed in. But if you're growing the Jennifer Rooks variety, that's the only one you do, and you're just saving like the biggest, juiciest ones every year, over time, all your tomatoes will get bigger and juicier. And so it's just the process of selection that you're going through. And that's all that – that's what everybody that, you know, that used to grow food plants did. That's where most of our, you know, our crop plants come from, is just over, you know, over generations, people selecting wild plants that had, you know, pawpaw, for example. It's a wild fruit tree. And typically pawpaws are about as big as a lime, but we've been selecting pawpaws that are bigger and bigger. Now they're as big as an avocado or even larger than that. And that's just this process of selection.
All right. And Barbara, we want to, as we're learning here, I want to ask you about pollination. I think we all learned in elementary and middle school that bees are pollinating our flowers and our fruit plants. We're concerned about what's been happening with the North American bee population, but it's really more complicated than that, isn't it? Give us a sort of a pollination 101 for new or novice gardeners.
So pollination, when it comes to seed saving, and we'll keep it within that realm, pollination you just need in your garden. So good pollinators are good. But if you want to seed save, let's just say you want to save corn seed. Well, corn is wind pollinated, not insect pollinated. So it needs to be in blocks, and the pollen goes through the wind. So you can't abut up two different kinds of corn, especially if it's a super sweet corn and a standard corn. The crosshair, the seed you would save, doesn't have the best of either of those varieties. So if you want to do corn, the better thing to do then would be to distance it in time, to grow an early variety and save that so the pollen is done by the time your later variety. So you've separated by time versus space. So when you save seed, like if you wanted to save squashes, squashes are all pollinated by insects. So the easiest thing to do, back to the Jennifer Rooks varieties there, if we wanted to have the Jennifer Rooks cucumber, is to only grow, if your garden is small, to grow just one variety. And this assumes you aren't surrounded by cucumber growers in your neighborhood. And that way you'll know that it is true that all the pollination that happened within there are that one variety. And then just do what Bill said. Look at your crop and save the best ones and grow them out again. And over time, that quality will keep improving.
We're going to go to Bob, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. My central concern in gardening is the health of the soil and how to enrich it. And my question is, when is the best time to do that, really? I've always sort of heard that, and I've done this as an organic gardener working, volunteering somewhere, that you add horse manure and not really raw horse manure nor fully composted horse manure, but horse manure that's somewhere in between, partly composted. In the fall, you know, when everything else is done, you mix it in with a rototiller. And I've heard that that's the best way to improve the soil really for the spring rather than putting it in the spring, which is also good, of course, but not as good as putting it in the fall, because by putting it in the late fall, even as late as November, there's that time that it's breaking down. I'm not sure that's 100% true, and that's basically what I'm asking.
Okay.
And my second question is, when is really the best time to do a soil test? In the fall or in the spring, and why? And of course, it would be effective. Doing it in the fall or doing it in the spring would be affected by the enriching of the soil that you've done before, I suppose, I'm sure.
All right. Well, Bob, thanks. I'll turn this to, I assume you're talking about a vegetable garden, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Raised beds, actually.
I'll turn that to Barbara. I think I've heard you say in the past that you're not a big fan of rototilling, are you?
Not big, but turning in compost, I certainly understand. The whole age, middle ground kind of compost thing, if you're going to apply it in the fall, it can be pretty, it can be fresh because it's going to be months in the ground. So the hardest thing with horse manure in particular is the seed bank you're going to get. So, but if this this gardener Bob goes with and has a supply of it and can deal with the weed seed, all's fine. Anytime you want to. If you choose fall is the best time to soil sample because it gives you time to apply lime or other slow to break down minerals now and have them be effective by the spring. The results, I would take the soil test after I applied by manure, because you want that to be reflected in the analysis that comes for the springtime. And I would just write a little note on the form saying applied whatever you did, just to let them know and put the date.
So right now is a good time
Absolutely.
To get a soil sample done. And mm-hmm. Bill, you're nodding.
Yeah. Well, you can do it in the spring too, but Barbara's, you know, right. Lime takes a while to act. So if it's often there's a pH issue in our climate. And so you want to get the lime on in the fall because it takes a while for that to act. And the main reason, the main problem with using compost in the fall, especially manure compost, part of the reason you're using manure compost is for the nitrogen
right.
that it has. And nitrogen is very soluble. So it will leave the soil if there's nothing to catch it. So the reason people plant cover crops primarily, like rye, is a nitrogen catch. So that green winter rye will sequester that nitrogen over the winter time, and then when you dig it in or till it in the spring, that'll be released again in the spring rather than just washing out into the ground.
All right. Well, Bob, thanks so much for your question. I'm sure a lot of people are hoping to have a great raised bed and great soil next spring. We'll go here to Patty on Facebook says, is it time to plant garlic? Two guests nodding.
It's the time.
Two radio guests nodding.
I got to do mine. That's a good reminder.
Just being silly here. We'll go to George, who's calling from Sherman. Hi, George. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I work 6 months up in Maine and 6 months down on the east coast of Georgia and with the honeybees. And one of my favorite flowers is the lupine. And right now, as I drive around and work the bee yards, there's seed pods of lupine everywhere. And I'm wondering, can I harvest those and dry them out and be able to get them to take root? And secondly, would I be able to do that down in Georgia with those seeds, or are they only really a Maine flower?
You certainly can collect them now, definitely. It's funny, we were talking about lupin before we went on air. The key with lupin in next spring is to get them to germinate, you would take and rub them between two sheets of sandpaper for about 30 seconds because there's a hard seed coat on there. Soak them in water overnight, warm water, and if they've swollen and doubled or tripled in size, then plant those. If they haven't, you didn't rub hard enough, you have to do it again.
So sandpaper first,
then soak
overnight.
Yeah,
okay.
And sandpaper like a medium grit sandpaper, fine grit sandpaper. They wouldn't do very well in Georgia just because they're not a hot weather plant. You could potentially use them, you know, have them bloom in April, but they're probably not going to be perennial for you down in Georgia. They would just be an annual type of thing.
All right. Thanks for your question, George. Everybody loves lupin, and I know it's famously tough. So there's a good tip from Bill Kalina. We have an email from Liz. I love Browalia. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah.
It's hard to find in six packs nowadays, and every year it develops some sort of disease. Leaves get yellow, begin to droop, and the plant just wastes away. What causes this, and could improved culture prevent it?
Well, Browalia is actually related to tomatoes, as I'm remembering it. You know, I think they get some of the same blight problems that that plants, the solanums, get. It's one of those bedding plants that there isn't a lot of work doing. They're doing things to control the height on it. But what I've found is it's not a plant that likes to be in a lot of sun. When I planted it in sort of partial shade or afternoon shade, it does a lot better. It likes moisture in the soil. It doesn't do well with drought. And so in dry summer like this, it really stresses out. So I'm thinking it's more of a water stress and maybe too much sunlight to try it in a little shadier, damper place.
An email from Mimi. I have store-bought versus wild grape plants, both bred for northern temperatures. One purple, one green. Is there some way to test for ripeness other than sampling one from each bunch, looking for peak sweetness? If this matters, I mostly use them for eating out of hand and for drying for raisins.
I always just sample. I don't know. I mean, short of getting what's the sugar tester called, that you squish the fruit and you test it. But for just a backyard owner, you have to keep sampling.
Okay. Not a terrible thing to have to do. Okay, we'll go to Kathy, who is calling from Stockton. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead.
Hi, Dan. I have a question about the tomato patch that I've been growing for on the same patch for 4 or 5 years. And I had great yields. It gets a lot of sun, and I watered it. And I've used my own compost when I plant. So, but this year, it just hasn't done well. The yield has been terrible. I've done nothing different. I don't know. I buy my plants from the same nursery. I use my own compost, like I said. I've been watering regularly, but just they haven't been as good in terms of yield as I had in the past. Any ideas on why?
All right. Well, thanks, Kathy.
So, Kathy, you said you've grown, I think you said you grew, have been growing your tomatoes in the same place for many years. Is that right?
I would say 4 to 5 years.
4 to 5 years. And have you been seeing any diseases? I'm a little bit stymied as to why this year, because it was a pretty good tomato growing year. But to have less yield, did you plant more? Are they more shaded? Are shade trees growing up around this space? Any of those possibly ringing true? Did she go?
Kathy, are you there?
Yes, I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Yes, now we can. So have you had any?
No change in the shade cover. That's just the same. Number of plants has been the same. I don't understand. I've done nothing different.
Do the plants look healthy, just with not enough fruit?
No, they don't look so healthy. I couldn't see any observable disease, but the leaves weren't as plentiful, and the fruit certainly wasn't as plentiful.
Maybe just time for a soil test.
I was just going to say, it sounds like a nutrient thing then, that maybe your compost isn't delivering enough to maintain tomatoes over time. So try a soil test and see what happens.
I wondered that. I wondered if maybe I need to rotate, but this patch is so good and I don't have another space I could put them in.
Maybe just some additional fertilizer of whatever type you'd like might get you over the hump, but a soil test is certainly where I'd start.
And when someone orders a soil test from the Humane Cooperative Extension, will they receive recommendations with their result, this is what you need to add to?
Right. Either and you can choose if you want organic recommendations or conventional recommendations.
And they'll ask for the type of crop you're growing so they can tailor the recommendations to the type of crop you're growing. So.
Great. Thank you, Kathy. We'll go to Bill calling from New Hampton. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Your show is great.
Thank you.
I live on a rocky northeast-facing hillside, so I do all of my gardening in raised beds. And I'm calling about the concept of saving seeds and, you know, working with seeds year after year. I have a separate raised bed where I plant one or two or three, depending on what it is, of whatever I want to save seed for. And that's all that bed is for. I'm not tempted to eat anything out of it. That's all it's for. And I've been experimenting, and it's just a really wonderful way to live is with gardening.
Bill, how many years have you had a separate bed for saving your seeds?
Let's see. Is that 4th year now? On Sunday mornings, from 8 a.m. until 10 a.m. on 99.7 FM, there's a call-in talk show called the Paul Parent Garden Club out of Maine, 1-800, it's the Paul Parent Garden Club, 99.7 FM. I found him on the dial one morning when I was surfing the radio, and it just changed my life. I'm semi-invalid. I was kind of going, and I'm getting a little old, and I'm going, what am I going to do? And he was talking about everything. It's a beautiful call-in show. The guy
that's great, Bill. Well, I appreciate that tip, and also your enthusiasm for gardening.
And the nursery bed's a brilliant idea.
All right. Thanks for your call. And quickly, before we go to a break, I want to ask from Anne on Twitter. I have dozens of foxglove plants that have seeded themselves all over the garden. Can I transplant them this fall? I love foxgloves.
Do it sooner rather than later, because you want to get a good root system established, because that's as big as, you know, the bigger the plant in the fall, the bigger they'll be the next year when they bloom. So
Okay. Well, we do have to take another short break, but first, a look ahead at tomorrow's program. Join me for a discussion of the PBS documentary on the Vietnam War. It wraps up this evening, and we'd like to hear your thoughts on the program. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do CEI. Helping grow good jobs and shared prosperity with financing, business expertise, and policy solutions. CEIMaine.org. And Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
The Trump administration has issued more travel restrictions and a new policy that will monitor social media activity. Many Muslim travelers are anxious.
People are worried that they may go through 3, 4, 5 hours of questioning about their backgrounds, about their religious practice, you know, have their phones taken and searched.
The impact of tightening travel this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered can be heard from 4 to 6:30 every weekday evening on Maine Public Radio. And in about 20 minutes after Maine Calling, it's Ideas from the CBC, today's show on illiberal universities. Universities are supposed to be dedicated to the exchange of ideas, but according to social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, campuses now skew so far to the left that they've become what he calls political monocultures, in which voices that stray too far from liberal orthodoxy are shouted down. Ideas explores the complex question of diversity on campus. Ideas from the CBC, this afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, getting your garden ready for winter, tips on saving seeds, and answers to your gardening questions. Joining me today, Bill Kalina, Executive Director of the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, and Barbara Murphy, Coordinator for Gardeners Growing Healthy Communities. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Adrian calling from Stockton Springs. Hi, Adrian. Go ahead.
Hi. So I've been noticing that I have every day for the past 3 days some monarch butterflies that are fluttering around. And about 3 weeks ago, I had two monarch caterpillars that were on my Asclepias tuberosa, which I planted just for them, and it's doing quite well this year. And so I was looking at their development, and the caterpillars got very large. And then they disappeared completely. And I'm wondering whether or not they went through their cycle and the monarchs that I'm seeing might be the caterpillars that I saw.
They, you saw the caterpillars 2 or 3 weeks ago, you said?
Yes.
Yeah, I think there's a good chance that what happens is that when they get large enough to pupate, to metamorphose, they crawl off the milkweeds onto something nearby, like a shrub or some other structure. And
the only thing nearby is a dewberry.
Yeah, so they could crawl into that. They mainly want to get away from the plant, you know, into something else, as sort of a hiding thing. And then they'll, you know, the chrysalis obviously is very distinctive, but it's a little camouflage. And then that takes about a week or so, and then they'll hatch out. So I think that sounds about right, and those are the ones that you're seeing now are the ones that are getting ready to migrate down to Mexico. So they've got a long flight ahead of them.
And they take several generations to do that, I learned. That's really neat. Hey, Adrian, thank you so much for your call, and what a wonderful thing we have this year with all the monarch butterflies this season. It's really, really been fun. I'm going to go to Susan calling from Kingfield. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for taking my call. Your show gets better and better all the time.
Thank you.
My son is an arborist, so he has access to a lot of hardwood chips that he makes. And his wife, Jennifer Wilhelm, has been a community gardener for years and years. They don't till. They simply lay 6 to 10 inches of chips down, and then they put compost in rows on it and grow all their food in those. It's almost a weed-free kind of gardening.
Susan, when you say chips, what kind of chips?
Hardwood chips.
Like tree, ground-up
tree chips. Hardwood tree chips. Mm-hmm.
And then they put the compost right over the chips where they want to grow the next spring?
in rows. It sort of looks like a miniature raised bed, about 18 inches wide. And the very interesting thing about that is the weed-free aspect, of course. But the first year, those strips of compost are not so they don't yield as big a crop. When you put the new compost and then the year-old compost side by side, you'll see a height difference, almost double, in the year-old compost, as if all the bacteria, positive bacteria and so forth, have to marry between the compost and the chips and the soil beneath it. And when she weeds her acre of garden, she might take off maybe a 5-gallon bucket of weeds. There's so few weeds.
Wow. Okay, thanks for calling and sharing. Barbara, thoughts?
It's certainly many people and many books have been written about similar processes. I would always be interested in that first year with the fresh chips and the compost. That first year you try it, there might not be those nutrients might get tied up from the compost to break down the wood chips. But over time, that certainly is a system that's been proven to work.
All right, Susan, thank you so much for your call. We're going to go to Paul, who's calling from Western Maine. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. Nice show. I'll get right to my question here. I have pretty nice perennial gardens up here. I live high on a hill. I get good sun during the summer. That's why I've been pretty successful. It's very cold. When it does snow, it's very we get a lot of snow up here. And what I have been doing the last couple winters, I've been putting these gardens to bed. I've been giving them straw beds. I've got mixed reviews on that. What do you think about that?
Just putting straw over the plants as a winter protection, Paul?
Yeah, that's what I do.
The only danger with it is that it's the voles we were talking about earlier, that the rodents are really attracted to that and nesting
okay.
in there. So if you haven't had an issue with that, then it certainly it can help with winter protection for sure.
Okay.
To insulate the plants, but you might have trouble with, you know, if the rodents find it, they'll nest right in there and eat a lot of the stuff. So,
okay. And Paul, and Bill, let me ask you, if Paul were to have problems with rodents, what might be another option for him to protect his perennial beds from a harsh winter?
Well, it's tough because anything you're going to put on there as a blanket is going to be attractive to them. But you can put on, heavier mulch like the bark-based mulches and stuff like that, which acts, you know, have some insulation value too, that are less attractive to them.
Oh, mm-hmm. That'd be like a regular garden mulch you'd buy out of a nursery or whatever.
Yeah, like something, a composted softwood bark, composted pine bark.
And he said he has a lot of snow where he is.
Yes.
The snow itself is protective,
definitely.
Correct?
Definitely, yeah. 6 inches of snow or greater is great insulation. But, you know, the problem we have on the coast is it's irregular, whereas, you know, up where you are, if you've got consistent snow cover all winter, then that's providing great insulation for you. You probably don't need the other stuff. So.
And, Bill, would you apply now or would you wait till the ground freezes?
Either way. Yeah, it's easier to do it after you've done your fall cleanup when you've cut things back and rather than doing it now.
Okay, we're going to go to. Is this Bette in Scarborough?
Yes.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, I have a question about keeping certain vegetables growing in the same space year after year, whether that's a good idea or not. Specifically, I have done that with tomatoes and garlic. In the same beds year after year.
Sure. Well, Barbara, a lot of people don't have a choice. They've got one sunny spot in their yard. Can you rotate within that one small area?
It's not ideal, but it is what it is. So what you're going to try to do then is minimize disease and minimize disease falling back into the soil. So when your tomato leaves maybe get yellow or brown spotted, and they fall to the ground, that's disease-carrying spores oftentimes, just keep picking them up. When you have a small garden, there's just only so many things you can do. So you try to keep your soil really healthy with fresh organic matter and compost added every year, and you pick up as disease happens, and that goes a long way.
Bette, thanks for your question. We have, let's see here, an email. Oh, I don't have the name on this email. Is black tar spot virus from nearby maple trees a possible problem for my vegetable garden 20 feet away? I use baking soda spray solution for powdery mildew in vegetable garden. Would this help the trees?
Unfortunately, plant viruses are pretty much incurable. If the plant has a virus, unless you bring it into a laboratory or something, you can't really cure it. So it's very different than a fungus disease like powdery mildew. And there aren't antiviral drugs like there are for people with viruses. So unfortunately, no.
An email from Nancy. I have a large yard, 3/4 acre, a lot of lawn, and sandy soil. I don't care about weeds as long as the lawn is green and short, but I do have ants that have infested a lot of the yard and ruin whatever grows. After a while, they leave hard-packed soil where nothing grows. How to fix this? I hate to use pesticides. I have a varied landscape and do not want to cut back on lawn. Thank you. Ants. First time we've had an ants question.
Improve the organic matter of the lawn will help. It's the dry, sandy soil that the ants are attracted to. So adding a small amount on top of the lawn over time, I don't know of anything faster than that. Hmm. It's a long-term, slow process to get rid of ants.
David on Facebook writes, to the caller who asked about harvesting lupin along the side of roads, I live in a neighborhood where we had a beautiful roadside bank full of lupin until one year somebody came along and harvested all the seeds. Please caution your listeners about harvesting lupin seeds from private property or even town roads that abut neighborhoods. Are there ethical guidelines to harvesting lupin seeds?
Well, interestingly, lupin, you know, some people consider it an invasive species, so that's a whole other issue too. But the because it's not a native plant, it's a garden escape kind of thing. But it is a perennial. And so the lupin, you know, lupin plants do live from year to year, although they're kind of a short-lived perennial, so they do need to seed in. My rule of thumb with any seed collecting is obviously ask permission if it's not your land first. That's the most important thing. I totally agree. And if you are collecting seed, just take a little bit of seed from a bunch of different plants and don't get greedy. Just a few pods from several different plants is not going to make any difference. And you know, typically, like, town road right-of-ways, you know, are, as long as it's not on somebody's private property, is a pretty good place for seed collecting.
Okay, we'll go to Jeffrey from South Portland. Hi, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, yes, this is Jeffrey Berry. I just wanted to mention when I did my soil sample through the Cooperative Maine Extension, they based their recommendations on 1,000 square feet, and my garden was only 100, and I almost put in 10 times the amount of stuff.
Ah, yes.
And when I called in to ask about it, they're like, oh, no, we saw your calculations, but we base everything on 1,000. So I just figured I would share that with the rest of the listeners. Mm.
Ah,
good reminder.
Good reminder. If you've got small, divide their recommendation by the size of your plot. Thanks, Jeffrey, for calling in. We have an email from Jen. She writes, I put in a horseradish plant last spring. I want to relocate it to a better spot now or in the spring.
I'm going to say spring,
yeah,
but it's pretty hard to kill horseradish no matter what you do. So
you'll probably have some in both places
because
the root resprouts.
And then a lot more places.
Really? Yeah. Really? It's trouble. Mm. It's like mint that
well,
way?
Well, it's like a dandelion. It has a big taproot, and if you leave part of it in the ground, the taproot regrows. And so you end up – so it's not too – it's not – you could probably do it either time without too much trouble, but I would probably wait till the spring too. I agree.
Okay. Email from Ryan. We have an old account apple tree in our yard, unsure of variety. It's produced a large amount of fruit this year, but not as sweet as we would expect. Any advice on pruning to optimize fruit production and quality? I think, Ryan, people all over Maine have an old apple tree on their property and would like to know what to do.
The sweetness this year could be dulled just by the amount of rain. So larger fruit tend to have less sweet characteristics in some cases. But pruning is a whole nother topic because pruning is a springtime event, and it's sun and it's rubbing and adequate airflow. So I would recommend, you know, a good video or a good book for pruning for maximum yield and then thinning the fruit that does come. All needs to happen.
All right. We'll go to Mac, who's calling from Henniker, New Hampshire. Hi, Mac. Go ahead.
Hey. Yes, hi, Jennifer. I'm calling for two things. One is, being a former Fort Kent boy and now living in New Hampshire, I miss my ostrich ferns or fiddleheads. And the Connecticut River Valley has some, but not where I live. And I've tried to transplant from wild, and I have not been successful. So I need some pointers on that. And the second one is I would like to plant my onion sets and my shallots in the fall instead of to maximize the early spring growth. And I haven't been very successful. So is that not a preferred method?
I can do the onions. Onions for the fall means you would have planted them in August. So if you want to start your onions and have them, you know, harvestable in the July time period, let's say, it's August. If you do them much later than that, they really have a hard time staying in the ground if there's freezing and thawing. And even if you start them in August, they must be protected. So those are the things you need to do to be successful to pull them off, okay, overwintering them.
What about ostrich
fern? Ostrich fern, you know, certainly against the same with seeds. You know, make sure you have permission if you're digging them. But the key is they grow from sort of a brown, you know, it's a rhizome, but it's sort of a brown thing that sticks out of the ground. And you need to dig them before the fiddleheads show up. So, you know, in Aroostook County, that would be before maybe early May. And just fairly easy to move. I transplant them all the time at that time of year. So just when they're dormant in the spring, before the fiddleheads show up.
So pretty much as soon as the snow melts and the ground
yeah.
is workable?
And then you just take a shovel and cut around that crown, that brown protruding crown, and then transplant it, and they'll take right off.
All right. Well, thank you, Mac. I think I have time for one more question. We'll go to Jim on Twitter. He says, I'm sorry if you've covered this before, but how do I get rid of bittersweet? I've hacked it, poisoned it, burned it. No luck.
That sums it up.
Keep hacking, keep poisoning, keep burning?
Yeah, I mean, well, this is the case. I'm always a little leery talking about using herbicides because, you know, some people don't like to use them. But it's one of the cases where I do use, like, the triclopyr-type brush begone herbicide. Because the problem with bittersweet, if you cut the stems, it comes up by the thousands from the roots. And so the easiest way to get rid of bittersweet is if you have the big stems, to cut those this time of year. And then just treat the, you know, wearing protection, treat the stump and with, like, brush begone concentrate. And it pretty much will kill the roots, although the next year you'll have a few distorted ones coming out that you'll have to either pull out or treat again. But it I think that's the key, is getting the big stems this time of year rather than waiting.
Well, Jim, good luck to you, and you're not alone. Thank you, Barbara and Bill, for coming back. Barbara Murphy, coordinator for Gardeners Growing Healthy Communities, and Bill Kalina, the executive director of the Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. Owen Manahan answered your calls. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, your reaction to the Ken Burns PBS documentary about the Vietnam War. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.